point, you know, it's really hard sometimes when I do these kind of talks. I always get really nervous and think I'm going to run out of things to say. So then I bring all this stuff with me, and then I get down to the last session and realize that I've got a whole bunch more to say and I'll never have time to do it all and to figure out what's the most helpful, beneficial thing to do now, okay? There's one thing that I really wanted to make a point of following up on, because basically we touched on it in the earlier session, and that is, Mansur mentioned, how do you keep a support group from turning into a Bible study? And it's very interesting that I have talked to many people who have seen the same thing happen. That, and a part of the problem is that a lot of the Christian 12-step groups that are, going on now, in many cases, are being led by people who have no background or experience in recovery themselves. And we talked about this earlier, that too often times we've been kind of caught up in the fact that Christianity is totally a cognitive exercise, you know? That somehow if we get the right information, it'll all come out right in our lives, see? And so that's why they tend to get back into that old cognitive mode, right? Of giving out data. But I heard somebody once told me, I had a chance several years ago to spend a week in a hospital program just for adult children of alcoholics. And that was one of the most wonderful healing experiences I've ever had. But one of the things that they said about adult children of alcoholics, he said, that one of the counselors said during a lecture, that every adult child of an alcoholic is a data junkie. And by that he meant that, and it's true, that most people, even when it begins to dawn on them that they might need to be in recovery themselves, spend all kinds of time reading about it, sometimes for years, watching John Bradshaw on TV or something, you know, before they ever do anything themselves. And it's almost like right information does not necessarily mean right behavior. So we have to be so careful that it's not just data, and we don't want to turn people into data junkies. Who know a lot about recovery and can talk a good line, but have never had any real experiences of it in their own lives. Yeah, it's just like, it's what you said, man. Just a lot of, sounds like sometimes a lot of preachers, right? Who they tell people to do things they've never experienced themselves. I just like to talk a little bit about this section. It's something that appears in the recovery guide that the IHM put out, but it's not part of the tapes. In effective recovery programs, there are three distinct types of group settings that combined provide our clients with personal insights, encouragement, and education that will equip them to live a fulfilled and sober life. We can add a fourth group here too, and that is a church or worship setting. But I'm really a big believer in using the outside churches as well as outside support groups. The unique characteristics of each of these groups is illustrated in this in the following outline. And we need to keep these separate. I've been to missions who had a class that they call a support group, you know. Or else they had a therapy group, but they called it a support group. And yet each of these is uniquely different. They come in with simple help. What's a class? Well, a class has a designated teacher, like this, a lecturer, and it's a lecture format. The focus of a class, basically, is those in attendance are listening to the instructor, right? The participants listen, and they may also be... There might be time where the participants can provide feedback and offer questions. So for classes, of course, the major benefit is learning practical principles that can be used in life situations. I emphasize the practical, you know. Somebody once said that there are three reasons people don't do what they're supposed to or what they should do. The first reason why people don't do what they need to or should is because they don't know what it is. And that's really a big part of why a lot of people are in such a mess in our mission programs, is they've never been properly instructed about the Lord, about morality, about parenting, relationships, any of that. And so hopefully we do have a setup where we have classes and people can be learning, and we can teach things on their level and give them these life principles that they can use in a practical way. The next type of group is group therapy. And sometimes, that's a scary term. But a therapy group is a lot like a support group, except that a therapy group has a real facilitator. Hopefully a trained facilitator, someone who has had some background in group dynamics and understands how to lead a therapy group. And the format is instead of a lecture, it's more of a facilitated discussion or format. But I emphasize facilitated. There is a leader, and the leader of the therapy group ought to be the staff person who's basically in charge. The facilitator leads the discussion, usually dwelling on the specific needs of one or two individuals. It's impossible to do a therapy group that really focuses on everybody that's in there. I'd say ideally you should not have groups of any more than 8 or 12 people for a therapy group. And 5 to 8 is probably the most desired number, I think. Especially if you're going to be getting into some really in-depth things. And the focus is on the specific needs of one or two people. But one of the nice things about a therapy group is the fact that you're a facilitator and you're not a lecturer and you're not a counselor at the time either. You know what I'm saying? It's like this gives the other people in the group a chance to be part of this sort of a counseling dynamic, and that can be really great. Sometimes in therapy group settings, I've led them, and I've also been. I spent 6 months in group therapy myself in the earlier stages of my recovery. And it's really neat because you not only give a chance to give feedback to others and listen to what's going on and gain insights for yourself, but also sometimes it's easier to take something and hear something from another client who's in the battle with you than with the authoritative counselor. You know, sometimes the people who I've been living with for several weeks or months can see things in me that even the trained counselor cannot. So that's an important thing. But when we talk about a support group, we're talking about a setup where it's more an informal leader. And rather than focusing on the format is rather than just a lecture or a study, the focus is on basically giving each person in the group a chance to share from their heart. Now, a support group could be begun with a teaching of some sort, maybe a verse or one of the steps, that becomes kind of the theme of that group. But still there needs to be room in the support group for another person who has a total different need to still share, even if it's not on the theme. So it's not really a controlled thing, and in many cases we really want the Spirit to lead, and He will. Focusing on would be on each members' individual needs and thoughts, and also their feelings. Round robin means just starting at the left and giving each person a chance to share as we go around the circle or table or whatever. Each person shares in turn, others listen, and they give their feedback when it is their time to share. rather than what's called crosstalk, right, where a person shares and everybody gives them all kinds of advice, then the next person shares and they get all kinds of advice, that can be disruptive, and it's not the way to do it. As a matter of fact, one of the real blessings of support groups is that a lot of addicts, and I think see myself in this too, use verbiage as a defense mechanism. You know what I'm saying? All these words you keep pouring out of your mouth is a way for nobody to really know you, to keep them at a distance and keep talking to them so that they will never really get in touch with your issues and nail you on anything. And so learning to listen is one of the things that an addict can learn from a support group. To keep my mouth shut and to really learn what's going on by sharing the experiences of other people. Each participant shares in turn, others listen, give feedback when it's their turn to share. What's the major benefit? Well, there's several of them. Number one is acceptance. There's not many places in the world or in the church where you can go and talk about shameful, disgusting, embarrassing things and people still like you. But the benefit of the support group is because we have all done shameful, disgusting things. Somehow it creates a bond of unity and support that can be found in no other circumstance. And the acceptance. If I have a person filled with toxic shame and guilt and about all the things I've done and said, and the support group is a place where I can really, really understand God's forgiveness. Support and encouragement from a group of individuals with shared life experience. Insights are gained through the non-threatening sharing of others. So rather than a situation of group therapy where people are actually directing the discussion and sharing at you individually, the support group is more my sharing what's going on in my life, and my defenses aren't quite up so high, and that sometimes allows some of these truths and principles to find their way into my heart in ways that I maybe would not take it if I was directly confronted with it. Sometimes you're confronted more powerfully in a support group than you can in group therapy because your defenses are down, and God will bring home a certain thing to you. I'd like to mention too that we've made handouts of all of the overheads. There's a stack of them back there.
This one's not
in there?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Give me the first one, get them the
final one. Okay. I'll give you a few minutes. Progress and not perfection, folks. Okay. Okay. Oh, really? Okay. You'll have to actually use the actual overhead. Here you go. Just before we go on to the idea of support groups, I'd like to share something else with you here. These are John Wesley's small group rules, written in 1816. So, Christian support groups are not an occurrence of the 20th century. As a matter of fact, the word Methodist, that from which we get the word Methodist Church, talks about the method. And what was the method? It was small groups, small accountability groups, that spurned the greatest revival movement, or one of the greatest revival movements in Christianity. What did they do? They met at least once a week. They came together, a commitment to be together at an appointed hour. To begin with, they started with some prayer and singing. And then they got into meddling here. It says, to speak each of us in order, plainly and freely, the true state of our souls with the faults we have committed in thought or deed, and the temptations we have felt since our last meeting. When was the last time you got together with a group of Christians at your church and did that? Were they still like you?
We're not Methodists, so we
yeah.
can't.
Yeah. I don't think many Methodists are doing it today either. But basically, speaking freely and plainly, each in turn, the true state of our souls, the faults we've committed, thought or deed, temptations we've felt since our last meeting. To end every meeting with prayers suited to the state of each person. And then finally, to desire some person among us to speak his own state first and then to ask the rest in turn as many and as searching questions as may be concerning their state, their sins, and temptations. And like I said before, this is the method that spawned this tremendous revival. What's that? Well, it turns out that what they did is after everybody had a chance to share, they actually had a leader who asked some of the questions, some searching questions to give people a chance to share about. Right. Right. I'm involved right now with a group called Promise Keepers. And a big part of the Promise Keepers movement is that we have small accountability groups that get together once a week. And it's like a support group, but also there's the added accountability of just talking with each other and being honest with each other. What have you done this week? And yes, I've been there. Huh? As a matter of fact, I'm a point man for a 2,000 member inner city church in Kansas City. And this summer we're chartering 350 seat coaches to bring men out to the conference in Boulder.
Where are you on Promise Keepers? Where's the contact for that?
Okay, if you want to know more about Promise Keepers, talk to me after the meeting. Yes? Right. That's a good... Yeah, your point is that it's kind of like in the course of their sharing with one another, say someone has said, I committed this sin and I've got to go and make it right. When they got together the next week, someone said, did you follow up on that commitment? Did you... It established accountability. Okay. Okay.
Just, you're going to want to come to this one too?
Yeah.
Did you do it right now?
Did we have that copy for this either? Okay.
I don't know. I thought I had copies of everything. But
I thought so too. Anyhow, yeah, for people that are actually watching the video, I hope you have the copies too because we'll be making them available. So, what do you look for in a good support group? I do know we made copies of a list of about 6 or 10 sources to find out about support groups. Let me say quickly that the best support groups, I feel, don't say we're instead of AA or Al-Anon or NA, but we're a Christian support to those programs. And I feel so strongly about that because it'll give us a great opportunity then for some of those who are involved in NA and AA to also be a part of our Christian aspect of things, 12-step meetings. Involvement in a support group, basically, we talked about a place where individuals with similar struggles come together and they share their experience, strength, and hope with one another. It's an important part, another important step for becoming reconnected with other people. I said earlier that probably, you know, oftentimes I said this, that being homeless means I'm cut off from all meaningful human relationships. That's being addicted is the same thing. And so the support group is a really a safe place for me to begin reestablishing myself in the skill of relating to other people. It draws me out of myself, but also puts me in a very safe setting for reconnecting. You know, this whole idea of taking street people who sobered up and plugging them into a traditional church is a pretty scary thing, isn't it? And that's why I'm so thankful to God that there is such a thing as this Christian recovery movement. And because so many churches and all have begun to establish support groups, because I feel that's the absolute most important critical bridge between the mission and the church that we'll ever find. Because basically these support groups have to be made up of people in the church who are in recovery themselves and really can identify with the person from your mission and ease them into the congregation rather than just dumping them on a church. You know what I'm saying? To give them and to find sponsors, people in these support groups who will are sensitive to you and your men and will and women and will take them in as a project. And then to have some of these folks come to your mission to lead a support group, and conversely, to have places where your men and women can go out into the community and participate in their support groups. I see.
Because what happens when you begin to share items that they need to talk about, but it may be in violation of a rule and staff is sitting there?
Yeah, that's a good question. If a support group meets in a rescue mission, should staff be involved? I'd say I would have outside people coming in to lead it. I really would. And there's another aspect of it too. And that is, if I'm going to be in this support group, I should be a full participant, right? How much do we want people to know about our recovery, especially those who are very just getting started? There are situations where they could be in the support group with us, and they won't listen to us, and they'll lose respect for us. Or also, they'll learn stuff about us that they're going to use against us later. So I say no. If you're going to have a support group in the mission, find outside people to come help you with it. And also, that's a good break for the clients, too, not to have to contend with you and everything, you know?
We have a Christian 12-step group at our mission on Monday night. Our public school has 12-step meetings every day, but we have an in-house Christian 12-step group on Monday night. We've asked the staff to come from a different department who doesn't work with them then in our halfway program. Also, it's important that you have the same person each week, even if it's an outsider, have the same person, because if you're switching all the time, you lose that continuity, and also there's the trust factors.
That's an interesting point, yeah. What Ron said is that the support group does have a staff involved, but from a department that's not directly involved with the recovery program. It's kind of interesting. And also outside people come, and that you want to make sure that there's going to be consistency in who's involved.
I was involved with the group every Tuesday night here for 2 years, and that was one of the things we read. And I was a staff member, and what that means is staying here.
Right.
We didn't figure that.
But were you the primary counselor of those people?
Well, I coached with a person from that, you know, that department, and then I was coming in to make a five. But I was also taking the verbal for ours from people out of it.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you...
And as long as they knew you didn't take it out, that was just one of our rules, and
sure.
Then they just had to make it a problem.
Okay, so you said that this worked for you.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, he said basically that here he was involved with a meeting where it worked for him. Okay. Well, I think also another thing I want to tell you, and that is, for client, I think recovering staff people should be involved with support groups. But I think it's hard for a person in recovery who's going to support group for themselves to go to the same meetings as the client. Okay.
Well, we might have a small
therapy. Right. See, and, not, and I think that's what you're saying is that whenever you have staff involved, it seems like you always get into counseling. So it doesn't, it's not a support group anymore, it becomes a therapy group. So there's a little difference there again. Because I think part of a therapy group, the facilitator can share, reveal himself details of his life and struggles and stuff. It's part of his facilitating process, you see. But too often times, if it's led by staff, it becomes more of a therapy group than a support group. Okay, right, let me go through these rules, or the hallmarks or whatever, and to say that a healthy support group, first and foremost, protects the confidentiality of its participants by not disclosing what members share during the meetings to those outside of the group. You know something? If a detail of what is shared at a support group gets out, it's like if a detail of what goes on in a program or counseling session gets out to people who aren't authorized to share that, you've lost that person. You will never, ever, ever get them back. And not just that, but you'll have harmed the reputation of your group, and you almost sign off its failure right there. So that has to be really upfront understood, confidentiality. Number two, avoiding crosstalk, right? Which is basically interrupting out of turn and offering unsolicited advice and counseling during the meeting. And I can tell you this happens in NAAA, EA, Al-Anon, ACOA, as well as any of the Christian support groups. Everybody's got your experts, you know. Avoid those groups for your people. I would encourage you that if you're going to use any support group, Christian or not specifically Christian, I hate to use the word non-Christian, but not specifically Christian, that you make sure you visit it two or three times to know what's going on before you send people to it. Or at least have someone that you know involved with it that you trust. Don't just send them cold. There are some groups that are hostile toward Christianity, others that are not. And the only way you're going to find them is to visit them or get some referrals from people that you know. It's, in a lot of ways, support groups are a lot like churches, right? If I went to a church like I'm involved with the Assemblies of God, if I went to one Assembly of God, there are several that I visited where if I went to the first time, I would never go back because I just couldn't relate or whatever. And that's within one denomination. What if you just drop into any church on any street corner to find out what Christianity is like? You know, that's not a representative of the church and what Christianity is all about. In the same sense, you know, support groups are not some kind of monolithic thing. They're all the same. And if you're not a recovering person yourself, look for an open meeting and find out what's going there. And talk to people. And visit it. Number three, so this crosstalk thing, again, is always going to cause problems because usually it shows that it's a strong personality who's trying to exhibit undue influence that's not right. Number three is support group provides a recovering person with a combination of personal support and group accountability.
Without a facilitator, how do you avoid the problem?
Okay, without a facilitator, how do you avoid the crosstalk? Well, you probably have heard a term called group consciousness. Group consciousness is basically the commitment of the group that it actually monitors itself. And a good group has group consciousness so that when someone is getting out of turn, they will be confronted. Well, yeah, usually the best way if you don't have a group is not to find one leader, but to find, if you can, two or three leaders. That's the way you start a support group. Find that, and of course, the best person to start it is someone, I think personally, who's had NA and AA experience and some other support group experience. the support groups that turn into Bible studies are people who've never been part of a support group experience themselves. And so how can you create or replicate something that you've never done or experienced yourself? Okay, so group accountability is, you know, important. And basically just knowing that I have people I report to and that will care about what's going on in my life and wonder what's happening with me. The fourth thing is it provides a format for honest sharing of personal thoughts and ideas. Again, because, you know, it gives people a chance to process things by talking about them. And there really is a tremendous healing value to talk, to get things out and to share. It's a tremendously healing experience. Also, it's a safe and non-judgmental environment for the risky experience of exploring and verbalizing emotions. A support group, a healthy one, provides a lot of room and for feelings. And you hear people verbalizing, expressing feelings. And people aren't rejected or judged by any of those other feelings. Also, a healthy support group supplements the entire recovery process and is not the single focus or an end in itself. What I mean by that is the group isn't recovery. It's not the sum total end of it. It's not really a program. It's more a support and a supplement to the entire process. Also, a good support group, it communicates acceptance and freedom of expression without fear of rejection. People aren't censured or confronted by sharing honest, when they share honest and difficult feelings and things. Promotes an atmosphere of positive reinforcement and hopefulness. I don't know if you've ever been to a meeting where it sounds so negative. And there are such groups like that. It's like it doesn't really do what you want it to. Hopefully it's a group where people are sharing hopefulness and good experiences and positive reinforcement. Maintains a family environment or atmosphere into which each individual feels that he or she can fit. It's an amazing experience. Like I said, in the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, the only qualification for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. That's all you need to be there. It's one of the few. It's one of the groups with the, you know, least exclusive membership that, you know, that I've ever seen. And again, because we're coming together with the stated, unverbalized understanding that we're here because we have problems and we want to work on them together, it's a really a super safe place. And it really does become a family atmosphere. Again, to help people to sense again that belonging and being part of something that's good for them. Another aspect of it is there are mature, stable leaders, but it's not controlled by one or a few dominant people. Again, that the group consciousness is working, and it's not being dominated by somebody. And also that it has a definite format for its meetings, that it's not rambling, directionless discussions. And that's why 12-step groups are so good, because they have a format. I don't want to go too much farther by letting you know that I really believe honestly that anybody who wants to use the 12 steps in their program and wants to counsel addicts needs to read these two books. This one is the Big Book of AA. And this is the 12 steps and 12 traditions, which is more of an explanation on the 12 steps and how they apply. They're very simple things. They have a lot of good stories. Anybody that's with you who's been in treatment has been exposed to these things. The Big Book and the 12 by 12 is what they go by. And I have the address for AA World Services. Many bookstores, you can go to the public library, they're all over the place. But if this is what you're going to be doing and the people that you're going to be working with, be sure that you read these things.
Right, that's blasphemy. I mean, the big book of the faith is the Bible, man.
You didn't say that.
I didn't
say it replaces the Bible.
Right.
Well, I mean,
you're putting words in his mouth.
Oh, I know. I'm just trying to be a facetious.
Yeah.
You hear this every day.
Yes, it's not, you know, here's the thing, okay? We have God's Word, and it's the rule and the guide by which all truth must be judged, right? But I trust the Lord that everybody in this room is rooted and grounded in God's truth enough so that if you run across baloney, you can throw it out, right? I mean, what if you acted upon seriously every sermon you ever heard? You'd be pretty mixed up. You've probably done some pretty crazy things. I know I've heard some pretty crazy things talked about in the pulpit.
Also, better never read the newspaper. That's the idea.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah. You can never watch television, you can never read a newspaper or a magazine article. But, you know, and again, I have a hard time with people who are so against this stuff, because I believe the scripture is clear that all truth is of God, right? No, I'm not. Like I talked about the Gorski book, Passages to Recovery, and also I really encourage you to take advantage of training offered by mental health and substance abuse services and things like that too. And go there with a critical ear and learn what you can, reject what you need to. But there is so much good stuff that if you don't, you're depriving yourself of a lot of good equipping and tools and training. That's right. There are some stories that, you know, you can take with a grain of salt, but there are enough good principles in the big book that if you're in this field and you haven't read it, you're missing out. That's all I can say. Any other comments or questions about this area? That's a very good point. That Fred mentioned that it was an experience with God that started AA with Bill Wilson. Here's the interesting part of it. Bill Wilson was a New York stockbroker, one of the co-founders of AA, and he had a friend named Ebbie Thatcher, who was working in a rescue mission in New York City that was started by an evangelist named Samuel Shoemaker. And Bill Wilson went down to that rescue mission and had dinner with Ebbie T, who was working as a volunteer down there, and he stayed for the gospel service at the rescue mission. And it was after that gospel service that he went home and had his spiritual awakening. That eventually, after meeting Bob, or Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio, resulted in the 12 steps and the AA program. And along with that, both Dr. Bob and Bill W. were involved with the Oxford groups. And the Oxford groups were small Christian home meetings where people did a lot of the things like we read about in Wesley's Small Group Rules. And they weren't necessarily for addicts, and they were for Christians of all sorts to practice these principles. And the 12 steps were based basically on the Oxford group's 6 principles, which are integrated into the 12 steps today. It was only actually later on that the earlier AAs separated from the Oxford groups, mainly because they needed to deal with just the alcoholics and needed a simpler program in many ways. That's a good point. The 12 steps come from Scripture. There's no reason why we just wouldn't want to use the Scriptures. I'm saying, my feeling is this, okay? If you don't like the 12 steps, don't use them. But make sure that you use the principles of them. Because if you don't, you're going to miss dealing with the most important aspect and needs of the addict, okay? But using the 12 steps is a way for us to integrate people into the support community that's out there. You see, recovery is not a do-it-yourself process. You need to be involved with other people who are committed to the same process of growth and healing, right? By using the 12 steps, we're enabling people that we work with to identify with a great movement and a whole community of people that will be there to support them and encourage them long after we leave. See, the other two talks I gave, we talked about the process in counseling with people, where the mission provides an overall structure, and the many kids that say our programs are like a beautiful greenhouse, where these newly found shoots of recovery and spiritual growth are just starting. So it's a very protective environment, and we're providing external means for the structure until growth occurs. The process involves us taking this external environment and moving that external environment into the person inside. That's why with our children, right, we start in the beginning with external structure, which means the spanking, right? And hopefully we'll have trained them enough by the time they get to be older that those disciplines that we enforce become an internalized set of principles that guide them through their lives, you see. Well, people are coming to us, to our programs, without that external structure or internal structure. Their lives are out of control. They've got no real direction except usually the next drug or drink, right? And so that's why in the beginning we need to be kind of a hardcore. We need to practically be telling them what to do every minute of the day in the beginning. And then, but if we move from that highly structured thing where really, it needs to be, in the beginning, a 24-hour program with as little free time as possible. And then you move people along in the process to where they have, they're doing more outside things and more free time, because we're hoping that we're growing into them the internalized discipline. Now, the whole issue that I wanted to talk about for the last few minutes in recovery planning is the aftercare discharge process. And we have to have an aftercare plan where people begin thinking through what their lives are going to be like outside of the mission. And a part of good aftercare planning is making sure that these people out there are plugged into support systems that will keep them on and growing in the things they've learned while they were with us. You see what I'm saying?
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over.
And so talking the 12-step lingo is not, it's not limited to the steps or the program, but it's actually introducing them to a whole community of people out there that are committed to the same process of growth that they are. And it's a unique process of growth that's just not typically found in the normal activities of the average church.
On the support groups that you made available on your handout, you have time to go over those briefly?
I know. You can talk to me sometime, though. I'll give you my 800 number again if you want to talk about some of this stuff. It's 800-624-5156. 800-624-5156. Yes. That's an interesting point. There are situations where support groups become the church, and a lot of times, you know, if any healthy support group doesn't want to do that. If you look at AA traditions going all the way back, they say, we're not here to be your church. And they encourage people to be involved in organized spiritual life and community. And that will, the AA group will not become a person's church if we're discipling them all the while they're with us and instructing them as to how the church fits into the recovery process and doing a definite plan of introducing them into the life and body of a church, even to having pastors who understand our program and are oriented to what we're doing, having people and families from the church out there adopting and sponsoring people. You know what I think? I think the reason normally why the AA people, AA becomes people's total spirituality is because they're intimidated by the church. That they don't relate to it, they're afraid of it, and that most churches, honestly, have no good process within them for taking new people, especially our clients from the streets, into the life of their body. Most of them have no clue what to do with them. Most of them, and I've seen this, and it's the saddest thing, it breaks my heart. I've been to churches where I've seen this. The mission van pulls up in front. The guys all stay in one little group together. They sit off in one corner, no one talks to them, and they shuffle out in one group talking with each other, and that's their total experience of the church. And that's why we need to have a process again, that we have contacts in those churches, that we know people, that they're on our team. And I'm telling you that if there are churches that are not willing to be part of that, we don't use them. I can tell you something else. I belong to a church in Michigan that had, by the time I left, 25% of its members were graduates of our program. And on the deacon board were some of our former clients. And, you know, pray to God that there would be more churches like that. And that was, of course, over a 10-year process. That's good. That's a good point. As you said before, people, there's a theology of, you know, you're saved, you're not an alcoholic, you're delivered, don't worry about it. And so people forget totally the maintenance that they need to stay in recovery. I can tell you what, I, as a recovering addict, I have a tremendous ability to become self-deceived. And if I don't have external sources of information out there, and reminders to me, I will lapse into a state of complacency that becomes terribly dangerous to me. And that's usually the result of that philosophy.
I think part of the problem, and my understanding of reading those Bob first put together, they clearly say that God has you know him. And but what has happened through the years is that replaced with a higher power concept. So therefore, many groups now have really gotten away from God as you know, but higher power. And your higher power can be a door knob, it can be a chair, it can be your wife, it can be anything that you desire, could be your higher power. And I think that's part of the problem. But then, when you listen to Father Martin, I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with Father Martin, who's a Catholic, who has become the greatest proponent of AA within Baptist Christendom. They say that the AA compliment, excuse me, 12-step principles, is the next best thing since the gospel itself. That it's so kind of like Paul's writing, that they become so perfected in their simplicity. That's why they use not only for alcoholics, but for any of for substance abuse, for victims of incest, victims of abuse, overeaters, and all. You can go on down the list because, again, the principles themselves are the handles, not only steps, but the handles that you can grab hold of. So we, as Christians, cannot leave them in a vacuum. We have to know the supporting scriptures so that, again, we have to be bilingual. We have to be able to quote the supporting scriptures. I think if we just see the 12 steps isolated,
naturally, yes, you're going to have a problem. But if they really put it in context, then I think they're really beautiful.
Yeah, I think just to summarize what you're saying is the 12 steps are a simplified outline of discipleship for people with compulsive disorders.
One thing is our responsibility just as Christians just to pray and see.
Yes.
Whether it's AA helping with that same group and us helping the group too.
Yeah, I think that we don't. I think we need to just not be so aggressive and defensive, and use the attraction, not promotion principle. You know, but I have to say one thing. You know, that you're saying here, and that is, God is really working through this whole thing, and I'm afraid that. That if we aren't sensitive to what he's doing in this whole, especially now the whole Christian recovery movement, we're robbing our people of one of the greatest resources they could possibly have. And I also believe honestly that the reason why the New Age people and why sometimes people's limited experience, limited the AA group is to their total experience, is because we have abandoned them. The Christians have abandoned them. And that there hasn't been anybody or enough of us as Christians to be in these groups and to share and be honest about what's going on and let people see how Christ makes a difference to us. I'm involved personally, committed to a secular, or I should say not specifically Christian, support group. And the traditions say, I can't tell you what one it is, but I have had really significant opportunities to witness. And it has not been so much, preachy type evangelism, but you're not going to find a group of people with a greater hunger and desire looking for more options and change in their lives than there. And we have, the IEGM does have a book called Two Tracks, One Goal. I don't know if you've seen that, by Cal Chambers, who's been a chaplain to AA for many, many years. And he goes into how that has been a fantastic opportunity for him. By participating in these things and using them in a discerning way, we're not giving a stamp of approval to everything that goes on there or everything that happens in the name of AA, but we are saying, well, there's some principles here that we ought to be using and taking advantage of, and if we don't, we're not going to provide people with all they need, see? Because even there is not there's not a Christian support group in every community yet, but if people could understand the biblical basis even of the not specifically Christian support groups, they'll still be a vehicle where they can grow and learn. I said before, when I did the thing about the phases of recovery, Terence Gorski says there are really six definite phases of recovery everybody passes through, but at the rescue mission, we'll only take them to maybe 2.5, 3.5 of the Gorski's six phases. The rest of them have to be worked out in real life outside of a structured program. But if they're not involved with active recovery out there and involved with support groups and other sources of information and spiritual growth, they'll never, ever push through to the final stage of recovery, which Gorski calls maintenance. That's good. Right. Right. That's good. Great. Good. Okay, so Brother Bowers basically said, just shared about how really it was his AA involvement in the fellowship that brought him to Christ. And that it's the fellowship of people who are trying to stay sober and to grow, and it's a wonderful accepting place. Well, there are some groups that aren't all that good, but I can tell you basically, you need to visit them and find out where you... Yeah. Right. That's wonderful. Yeah. See, so you said you've got Christian sponsors, and you had one yourself. That's wonderful. This is going to... I've only got a half an hour. Okay, all right.
What do you do with the individual who says, I've got
Jesus.
I got enough. And this to me is blasphemy, because in
the
sense what he's into is denial.
How
do you break through that? 12 steps.
Boy, that's a big area. And would you call me sometime? We'll talk about that. I got 25 minutes. And, you know, I guess one of the things that I share with the folks that, you know, that brought me out here is that I like doing these things because I hope that through them people get to know me a little bit better in my heart and what I, you know, what kind of input I have had and experience I've had, and feel really free to call me. Because I, you know, the IUGM is an association of 250 rescue missions and thousands of workers like yourself. And we're there to serve you and available to come to your mission for consultation and to share with you as far as, you know, other resources and things that you could use in your programs and such. And that's why we're there. So please, it's you don't have to feel shy about calling us and stuff. The next thing I'd like to do just really quickly is I want to show you the plan, that a very simple plan for case management, and that's what we were going to talk about originally here anyway. So and you know, another good term for case management is, it would be RBO, recovery by objectives. I don't know if you've heard of MBO, Management by Objectives, but in a sense, what I'm advocating and was actually required by the state of Michigan for licensure of addiction programs, which the program I ran for 10 years, New Creation, was an addiction recovery program. It was licensed by the state. And so they basically required that you be working and setting up goals and objectives for your people. And so this is just a little form that I developed here to illustrate how this can all be done here. It's almost like, as I said before, we should have kind of two tracks here in our program. A little higher up here, you'd have, you know, it's something that everybody goes through, right? You have a curriculum of classes that everybody cycles through, recreational activities, support groups, therapy groups, other things that everybody involved with the program participates in. But yet, we don't want to do it things totally as a group.
But we'd like to get into each person's life and each person's needs as an individual. And so this is one way we can do this. Now, the critical thing, and again, the recovery guide we published has a lot of great forms for data gathering. This recovery planning process should only happen after a good intake has happened. And we have 15, 20 page intake form that is in use by a lot of missions and has been very helpful. Because you really need to know people and their needs before you can do a lot to suggest some of the things they need to do while they're with you. But here's the different elements that really go into doing the initial recovery plan. I mentioned the intake interview. And I'd say within, 24 or 48 hours, you need a good comprehensive intake so you know who this person is, what some of their needs are. Also, it's possible for you to get discharge summaries from other programs. And if you're not doing this, you really need to. We have a form that you can use that's a legal document that you can fill out as a release of information, and your other programs will send you with permission of your client the work they've done with them in the past. And it's been exciting, to see how much work can be done by finding out what happened in other programs. We've gotten things like the MMPI and 15-page discharge summaries, and it really just gives us a lot of good insight. Also, any results of psychological tests that you might take, administer at your program, or that other people have given to people in the past. Also, the psychosocial interview, which is another 16, 18-page document that also is a data-gathering process. And I, encourage you, we used to have a staff person who did nothing but intakes, psychosocials and intakes. And that was so important, and she got to be so very good at giving the counselors a real good report on each person and really help them to start the process right away. In some cases, you might think about having people as your counselor trainee type people, and who've been through your program, maybe who desire to get into this field, they're working a good, really strong recovery program, and they want to get into it, this is the place where they start. Let them do all this data gathering for you. So, and then, of course, while you're talking about developing a recovery plan, things you talk about and discuss also goes into the plan. The results of medical screening, and I encourage you to make sure everyone that's going to be staying with you for a long term has a good, thorough medical screening. Not partially because you don't want to be liable of some medical incident that could have been prevented if something happens in your mission, but also you find out things about whether they might be HIV positive, if they have any medical problems that might have an impact on their stay with you. And the reality is, for most folks that we get, it has been a very, very long time since they've had a real good medical screening. Some may come to you with TB, so you got to know all this. Also, I do have a form called the Significant Other form. And if there are people that you can identify, parents, friends, or spouses of these folks, you can send this form to them and have them fill it out, or you could even do a telephone interview format to get the information. I have that with me too, and you can ask for that from me. But one thing I really caution you though, and that is if you get these forms from us or have similar forms, don't just hand the form to somebody and say, fill this out. The form should be filled out by the staff person or a trainee or whatever in an interview format. And
intake forms too.
Right, and intake forms too. And you may not get through all of that information in one session. That's okay. It's more important to get the good data. You don't want to rush through it.
Would you suggest intake and psychosocial interview form at the same time?
No. I think that my suggestion is do an initial intake within 24 hours, and then make it your goal to have the complete psychosocial done in 7 to 14 days. Because it might take even one or two sessions. So you might have someone with you for a week or two, just involved in the activities, until you've collected all the information you need to know from the other programs, your intake summaries, your medical screenings. Get all this stuff together first. And then what happens is you have a recovery planning session, right? Now, the thing we talked about here is this recovery plan is very much like a contract or a covenant. And it's a real spiritual principle. Because God, doesn't he work in covenants? It's always, I will if you will, right? And just like in business management, you find out that your employees will be more enthusiastic about a plan that they themselves have been a part of developing. You know what I'm saying? If you have a thing just dropped on you and this is what you must do, sometimes you can be very resistant, right? So the whole goal of this thing is, once we've collected all this data that we need, we set up a special appointment to be the recovery planning session. And what you want to do here is sit down and from the heart say, we're really glad that you're with us. And we'd like to take some time to talk about the things that you really want to work on in your life while you're here. You hear the emphasis there? We trust you, where you're at this point in your life, to know what your needs are. And you know the funny thing about it? If someone has been detoxified enough to be with you for a while and to be thinking about their lives for a while, they know a lot of what they need to do. We don't always have to dictate it to them or tell them. And you know, that's a good signal too, isn't it, of dignity and respect. That you're not just another number here. We're not just going to squeeze you through into our little mold. But our job, but we're here because we really want you to become the person you want to be and the person God wants you to be, and that you feel you could be with Jesus. And so let's talk about, number one, the problem areas in your life. While you're with us here at So-and-So Mission, what are some problems that you see in your life right now that you really want to deal with while you're here? And of course, it'll always be number one, sobriety, right? I want to be clean and sober. So my problem is I'm an addict, an alcoholic. There might be other problems, legal problems. I've got a court case. I've got to straighten out. I'd like to get reunited with my family. I have medical problems. I'd like to get my GED. And these are basically, again, problem areas in my life, first off. I don't have it, and I never finished high school. I have some broken relationships. I'm addicted. And be sure you also mention, you know, that there's a need to grow spiritually here and to be understood. So if we've listed a few of these problem areas, what are some goals? Now, a goal, of course, is an overriding statement of something that you'd like to accomplish, an overriding direction you'd like to go in. So the recovery goal of if I'm a drug addict, the recovery goal is sobriety, right? But you don't want to just stop at saying sobriety. You want to move down to a schedule of activities and objectives. Now, an objective is different than a goal, in that an objective is measurable, right? Just if one of my goals is to grow spiritually, that's a little hard to quantify and to measure. But an objective is something that you can say, yes, it's been done, it's measurable. So an objective could be to read through the Bible in my first 90 days. You know? Or read... It needs to be realistic, though, doesn't it? Let's say to read through the book of the New Testament in the first 6 months or whatever. But you know what I'm saying? Something good. You wouldn't want to have a recovery goal of earn my PhD while at the mission.
In our program, I do 10 chapters a day.
Wow. Quite ambitious.
Yeah. Well, there's a verse from 8:30 to 9:45.
Uh-huh. Again, these are all things that are measurable. If one of my recovery goals is sobriety, then I would put down here support group meetings 3 times a week. And then if you have an objective here, you put it over here with the dates accomplished by or 3 times a week, completed by June 1st, whatever, you see. And then if you're going to need outside referral sources, services, you might want to list who else might be involved, you know. If we put high school completion, certain medical clinic, whatever. And then you sign it, date it, and also you have here the person who sat down with you signs it and dates it as well. Now, you see, this signature thing is kind of a good thing, because I said before that resistance is probably the only... Either we dismiss people from our program because they did well, or because they have more problems than we can deal with, or because they're resisting, right? And a contract like this really is a super tool for fighting against resistance. Because if they said, these are my problems, this is what my goals and objectives are, and they signed it, at some later date, if they get resistant, you can say, excuse me, but didn't you say this is what you wanted to do? When did this all change now, you know? Aren't you going to stand by your words? Has this changed? Do you still believe this? Do you still think that you need this? You know? One of my favorite recovery slogans is, nothing changes till something changes. And so, tell me how things can be different if nothing has changed. So, in all of this, we're saying a recovery plan is a written plan of program services for each client, which is individualized and outlines realistic goals that will increase the possibility of his or her success. And that's what we're trying to do. And that's why when you say when people stop growing or whatever, or get bored with your program or aren't motivated, this is how you keep them motivated. As you begin developing goals that are important to them and find out what those are, and if they're important to them, they're going to keep moving forward. Basically, the plan describes how the resources of the program and outside community will be applied during an individual stay in your program. It should be a simple description of the problems addressed, a plan for involving family members if possible, statement of long and short-term goals, list of support services, list of who the team members are who's going to be involved, and a timeline for the recovery plan objectives. And basically, what we're saying here is that we're pulling this all together, and it's not a static thing. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's not once and for all tools and concrete. And that's why on the format I was using here, there are dates where you actually would update it. And every once in a while, you ought to be talking to the person themselves. Write down what you need. Listen to the plan. And oftentimes, what happens is they've been with you a while. They've gained some new insights. New issues have cropped up, and you might want to do this one in their file. And that's where we get into this idea of updating it. The other graph kind of showed you all the things that went into the initial one. Now here's all the other elements that will be necessary to update it. One of the things is assignments. And I'm really, really big on giving personalized homework to people. That if I have a book or whatever that deals with the person's problems, I'll encourage them to read it. You know, every counselor ought to have at his disposal a library of helpful books and tapes and videos that can be used in your program. And there might be situations where you have only one man or woman who's reading that book or viewing that tape themselves or together. But there are all ways to help deal with specific areas of their lives. Also, I encourage daily progress notes. And that is that every time someone is a supervisory kind of a fashion, kind of like on staff, that they record any significant events that have occurred during their shift, who they might have talked to, anything that maybe would have come up. See, what we need to do is every person that comes to us needs one primary staff person who's going to be their counselor. And you have about 12, 14 at the most per staff person. But they have one person that is their primary counselor that will work with them during their stay in that program or that phase. One counselor can keep track of 10 to 12 to 14 at the most. If you have a staff person trying to deal, if you have a staff person trying to do a good job with more people than that, you're severely understaffed, and you're just not going to accomplish in people's life what they need. You see, you should be able to have at least one good, solid, one-on-one session with everyone that's under your care every week. That's a good guide to see if you're overstaffed or not. They need at least one good one-on-one session a week. Okay, here we're saying. I think that 12 to 14 in a program, you can be involved with other aspects of administering the program. But I really feel honestly that when it comes to job assignments and all that, you should have one staff person who does nothing but that, who gives job assignments and is a supervisor of any work the clients perform. And that, it's much better that way, and there's much more consistency if there's one person doing that. The person who's involved with counseling, you know, it's kind of funny to me, again, that missions, we use the word chaplain so loosely, don't we? Sometimes it means counselor, sometimes it means warden, or jailkeeper, or whatever. And but hopefully it means spiritual advocate. And counselors, chaplains should be doing a lot of counseling, I think. And so we have to... One of the things I encourage is that when I visited Cleveland and I saw their chaplains running around like crazy and never having time to talk to the men, I said, why don't you have one good solid office day a week so that everybody knows this is your office day and they're not chasing you around for the keys to the van or anything else. But that, and that the chaplains, they're rotated so that they had their office day and they saw their men and their program on that office day. And then in some cases, maybe you need two office days. And then the other days are some of the helping to administer the program. And if you have people rotating that, you'll have, you know, I think, enough time. Just a matter of being creative about that. Other things is using the reports from outside resources that you use. I always say never use an outside resource unless you have some vehicle for them reporting back to you. If you're sending someone out to a clinic or to a counselor or to some sort of a social work, case management, educational people, whatever, be sure that you're getting some, you've developed a reporting system for them to let you know what's going on and keep in touch. Also, you should keep some notes on every one-on-one session. Peer review are those opportunities you might want to use sometimes where the other men in the program give feedback regarding the person's progress and growth and needs. That could be a real good thing. But let me tell you that my belief is that, and you talked about a democratic sort of a system that some missions use, where they have a client and councils or whatever determining the fate of the other people and handing out discipline. I think that's terrible. That's my honest opinion. And let me tell you why. Number one is every addict is a controller and is grandiose and would love to be in charge and boss other people around so they don't have to look at themselves. And you give them that kind of power and authority. It's just like what Paul said against Timothy. Lay hands on no man too quickly. Don't give people responsibility before they're ready. And missions are notorious for putting people who are struggling in positions of authority, and they crash and burn, and so does everybody else that they're responsible for. And that's very, very critical. We're in charge of the program. The counselors, the chaplains, the staff, we're in charge. We're the experts. We know people's needs. You open the door to a lot of games and power plays and crazy stuff that I don't think does people very much good. That happens so often. You're talking about a story, a guy who went to treatment and went working with the fences right away. It caused him a lot of problems and he relapsed, right? Our policy was no one came on the payroll without at least one good solid year of sobriety for paid staff. If you look at the different phases of recovery that we talked about earlier, if possible, the people who are doing most contact with the transients and the people who are not in recovery should be in that third phase. Hopefully, if they've been able to work through all those first two phases, they've got enough sobriety, enough knowledge, enough confidence within themselves in their own recovery so that they're not likely to be dragged down by the contact with the street people. So this is I think also every mission needs to have a book about this thick of community resources. And one of the most important things we can do is look at our staff, our expectation, our experience, their time that they have, and think, what can we do in-house well, and what needs to be referred out? See what I'm saying? No mission can offer everything to everybody. So we need to have a book with the names and phone numbers and people who are out there in a community that we will use for certain things. And then we need to look at our expertise within the staff. And maybe some people are better equipped through education, experience, whatever, as counselors. Maybe they need to do the bulk of that. Others may have other gifts. Try to get people configured even within the ministry who are walking in their gifts, and their major time and responsibility is geared upon the things that they are doing, can do best with. Okay? Is there any more questions before we get to the end here? Probably, yeah.
I just wanted to say, sometimes boards want you to be everything to everybody, and they want their mission to look like they're doing that, and sometimes that becomes not just a staff issue, but a board relations issue.
Okay, yeah, sometimes there are boards and people that expect us to do everything. Well, in a sense, we can do everything, but not necessarily in-house.
Right.
I mean, the best policy is a wise use of external resources balanced with internal ones. So be sure to pick up the handouts, and I'm going to be around this today for a couple more hours if you have any more questions. Thanks for being here and learning.